We're now going to tackle that contrast that I hope will make the first theological position that I sketched clearer and in relation to it. This is the theology that is promoted by Augustine, entrenched by Anselm, and refined by Aquinas. And since each of their last names begin with A, in my book I call this the triple A theology. It's nothing to do with helping cars that have broken down. It's just these three men are the three great champions of this point of view. And they are going to hold, in contrast, that God is the being with all perfections and only perfections. And in fact, that's how God's to be defined. That's what God is. So they want to say God is the being that has infinite love, mercy, justice, knowledge, power. These things are infinite in as God possesses them. However, this seems to run into a snag. And it's one that Augustine himself recognized. All three of these guys recognize it, and they all propose the same answer to it. If you say that God has infinite power, and you take that to mean that God can do anything, it runs into all kinds of trouble. For example, there's the wisecrack question we get from Sunday school kids. Well, if God can do anything, can he make a rock so big he can't lift it? And of course, either way you answer that, there's something God can't do. Can God make 4 and 4, 12 and 5/8? Can God make square circles? Well, this is the kind of thing that arises if you say God can do anything. So what these thinkers in this line proposed, particularly Thomas Aquinas, is that God can do anything that is possible. He can't do impossible things like make circles square or make a rock so big he can't lift it. But anything that's possible, God can do. And by doing this, he recognizes that he has to do something with the logical laws, the law of non-contradiction. And so he includes that in the being of God. Among the perfections, then, are all of the necessary truths. The laws of logic and mathematics are also all parts of this, for Plato was a separate realm of perfections, and now for these three thinkers, all converges in God. But they didn't want to say, they didn't want to put this, well, see, there are these perfections, and now God's the being that has them all. That makes the perfections prior to God. That means there couldn't be God unless there were perfections. And that sounds wrong. It is wrong, and they were right to be sensitive to this. And so what Augustine proposes right away is, it's not that God possesses these. He just is them. He is the unity of all the perfections. We can't conceive what that unity would be like because we don't know what it is to say that goodness is the same as justice, is the same as power, is the same as knowledge, is the same as mercy. But in God, since there's only one God, all these perfections are unified in a way we can't conceive of. In our world and to our intelligence, we have to break them up. We name them. So this is their view of the very nature of God. God's the being with all and only perfections. Among other things, he has perfect existence, which means he doesn't depend on anything else. He's self-existent. So they include that. And then they want to say it's not that there's a being called God and there are all these perfections that he didn't create and then he has them that would make him depend on them, but that God is the unity of the perfections. So it's not that the perfections exist independently of God. God is the perfections, and the perfections are God. That's just about the reverse of the theology I sketched over here. The earlier one, this is the one that the Greek Orthodox tradition has held ever since the 4th century. Expositors of this view are the Cappadocian Fathers, St. Basil of Caesarea, Gregory Nazianzus, and St. Gregory of Nyssa, and Basil's sister, Macrina. and it was rediscovered at the time of the Reformation. I find this view expressed often enough in Luther and explicitly endorsed in Calvin, by Calvin. But it was not followed by Protestantism generally. Luther and Calvin risked their lives to bring reform to the church. And the theology that of the Eastern Church, which they rediscovered, was just a sidelight. As far as the Protestant movement in general is concerned, it went forward with what it saw as reforms of the church and the liturgy and all the rest. But they did not follow Luther and Calvin on their doctrine of God. That doesn't mean nobody did. I mean, I'm talking about Protestantism as a worldwide movement as a whole. The prevailing theology is still the AAA theology. So here you have, yes, God has characteristics we can understand. That's because God actually enters into creation, takes on characteristics we can understand, deals with us in ways we can conceive of and understand and know, in order to know the nature in which, and this is the way John Calvin puts it, the nature in which he is pleased to manifest himself. It's his choice. Over here, nothing is God's choice. God just is the being with all and only perfections, and so he has to act in accordance with them. In a real sense, God doesn't have as much free will as you and I on this view, because God's compelled by the perfections that he just is to act in the ways he does. Let's do a little more contrast of this. I remind you that I had said before that Basil of Caesarea commented, if there are perfections, God created them. Maybe he was expressing doubt, and indeed the Cappadocians and the other theologians of the East, Eastern Church, held a conference after writing of the Nicene Creed, and in that post-conference they commented on the Nicene Creed. And one of the major thrusts of that was the rejection of Plato. That's not how a Christian is to see its relationship with God. It's not that there just are perfections and they just are God. That would say then that God did not create everything visible or invisible. So that's not a position we're ever going to take. And in the Western Church, Latin-speaking Church, they did take exactly that. The last of the Cappadocians died in 397. Augustine lived until 430. So that could place it in time for you. If you remember, the Nicene Creed was completed in 325. So this is ancient stuff, but mightily important and still powerfully expressed and maintained by the two theological traditions. I'm hoping that this much of a contrast will make this clear now. And I'm sorry I can't hear you answer whether it is or it isn't, but we'll come back and we'll do a little more and we'll review it again.